fabricated signs saying you can't support failure, close Dyett High School. They got on the microphone and mumbled and ranted incoherent statements. And so those were not the people that struggled for that school. And those will not be the people that lead Dyett's renaissance as Dyett Global Leadership at Green Technology High School.
G2 Brown, thanks so much for being with us. National Director of the Journey for Justice Alliance. He's in the 19th day of a hunger strike with other hunger strikers around Chicago public schools. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Steve Martinez, Miguel Noguera, and Mike DiFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalo.
Hey, this is Mark Cano from the band Athenaeum. You're listening to WHFR.FM, the station that's making waves.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to a special edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek, station advisor here at WHFR.FM. This show has been pre-recorded for broadcast on September 4th, not that early, and 2015, and today is September 2nd. So it's only 2 days earlier, folks. I know last week on the show I said I would put Ralph Nader's Radio Hour in place, but I'm sorry. There are stories here, you know. So I stopped packing my bags, and because I'm going out of town this weekend, and here we go. Let's see what's happening in local news. You know, the new WHFR Journal is local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. And as I said, today for me is September 2nd, 2015. We're looking back to Sunday, August 30th in the Dearborn Press and Guide. And we see that a nice honor again has gone to three area colleges and universities. The Michigan's Veterans Affairs Agency has declared that the University of Michigan Dearborn, Central Michigan University, which has a Dearborn campus, and Henry Ford College as veteran-friendly schools. The three are among 57 educational institutions in Michigan to receive the distinction, and among 28 to also receive gold level status. We've had that recognition, I think, for quite a few years now. I think we're one of the first, because I've been around the college since 1968, and WHFR began in 1985, but it seems to me we were one of the first colleges in Michigan to actually have a Veterans Affairs coordinator, and you know, no one else did. So they were a specialist in helping Vietnam veterans get back, get their lives together when they returned from fighting and killing and getting injured, unfortunately. And so we're still there. We're still there for the community, as are University of Michigan Dearborn and Central Michigan University from their Dearborn campus. So we're turning through the pages now of the Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday. And I think that's it. Yeah. We can go quickly here. Oh, we got lots of stories, though. Looking at the Dearborn Times-Herald, which is fresh from my mailbox today. Again, for me, it's September 2nd. For you listening to the show, the show is pre-recorded on September 4th. So the Dearborn Times-Herald says the Dearborn schools are discussing some busing options. They're exploring discussing new options for its current bus system. During August 24th meeting, board members awarded a one-year $750,000 extension to Trinity Transportation based on no increase in unit price. So they're going to be forming a committee involving instruction and transportation, said Superintendent Glenn Maliko. We will study how our money is being spent, efficiency, and will involve representatives from the community. Trustee Mary Pletchikoff asked the board to look into the ideas of neighboring districts regarding transportation. So that's good to share ideas. So apparently they don't have all their ideas together. That's a huge chunk of change, a one-year $750,000 extension to the busing that's going on right now. And when they talk about unit pricing, I'm not sure what they mean by that. Number of buses, number of students. The article is continued on page 8A. And, you know, if you really have questions like this and you have a paper to look at, then you yourself can actually turn the pages. And that's an amazing thing. Yeah. So let's see here. Apparently their big issue is recruiting bus drivers. And there's a shortage, not only at the local, but the state level. And the district has only 6 full-time bus drivers, with the remaining working part-time. And they're thinking maybe they need more full-time bus drivers. Bus drivers have to obtain multiple licenses, pass 4 Department of Transportation tests, complete safety training, have a high school diploma, and pass drug and alcohol screenings, too. And, of course, the shift is difficult. That morning and then late afternoon shift gives them a whole day with not too much to do. And so it's hard to attract people to something like that, I guess. Okay, that's the rest of the story. So we don't know about that pricing issue at this point. So paging through the Dearborn Times-Herald for this week. Of course, the legislature fails again on Michigan roads. And that's, I think, something you already heard probably from the statewide news. I trust you've heard about that. And guess what? They're in adjournment. That's right. They're taking the last couple weeks off because, you know, they've not done so much that they're tired. Yeah. And there's an editorial there from the Livingston Daily Press and Argus in the Press and Guide, Dearborn Edition, the Times-Herald, Dearborn Edition, and, we hope that something can be done. The problem especially was, it looks like the Senate agreed to $600 million, this is the Senate in Lansing, $600 million in additional, as I call them, and I think it's true, user fees for car registrations and license renewals, okay? Oh, and gas tax. Yeah. And, but that won't cover it all. So the Republicans there want to slash budgets in Michigan, $600 million. And that would affect a lot of services to people that can't afford to help themselves, the needy. And Governor Snyder, I think to his credit, and that's an opinion of mine, remember all opinions expressed on this show during this hour are not necessarily those of Henry Ford College. We thank them for continued support in our effort to give ideas that make you think. Don't believe anything we say, but think about it, do your research, ask questions, and then make a decision and take some action if at all possible. But Governor Snyder said, we can't take $600 million from the people that need it most, like education, like prisons, like social services, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, I think, to his credit as at least a close to moderate, although conservative, Republican governor. In any event, maybe he's one of those conservatives with a heart that George W. Bush talked about years and years ago, which he stopped talking about as soon as he was into his presidency. But anyway, as I see it, and as Representative George Gerani, Democrat, said on this show a couple months ago, the user fees coming from gas tax and car registrations and licensing would only work out to about $50 per driver, $50 per car per year. And that would raise the whole $1.2 billion. And we'd be done with it. And we could start fixing our roads and our bridges decently. Although, as I said, I think we should go to the level 2 quality, costs us a little bit more, but oh, it'll last so much longer and be better in the long run. Fewer repairs, fewer roadblocks per year. And, of course, get some contracts out there that have guarantees attached so that the builders have to stand behind their work and the quality. So with those two caveats, user fees. And Republicans don't seem to have a problem, even Tea Partiers, with user fees when it comes to things like, ooh, hunting licenses and stuff like that. So I'm going to private school. They think that's great. People are paying the tuition themselves. That's user fees, okay? Well, if people want to drive on the highways in gasoline-powered cars, they need to pay user fees. If people have electric cars, they might have to pay higher registration fees because they don't use gas, do they? Anyway, so good for the Times Herald of putting in the, again, chiding the legislature to do something. I think we're very, very tired, all of us collectively in Michigan, that we can't get the roads fixed, even though it's a priority and even though there's a simple answer, and we call it user fees. Okay. And just turning through the last couple of pages here on the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. And my name is Jay Koronek. Remember, you're listening to the station Making Waves. We're independent, non-commercial station from Henry Ford College. And, yep, an all-volunteer student and alumni staff, with the exception of yours truly and just two others. Wow. Well, in terms of summary of what's happening this week, it's fresh today. I don't know about Friday, but here's Jack Lessenberry from Michigan Radio, michiganradio.org, and I think his co-host here, talking about what's going on this week and his opinions about it as prompted by his co-host. Let's listen to that, and we'll be back with more stories from Dearborn and the surrounding area.
Democratic and Republican.
We're going to go out, and we will create more and better jobs, and we will be in a great state again.
The city council is considering whether to put a measure on the ballot.
I'm very concerned about our budget.
Governor Rick Snyder.
It's Wednesday, the morning we talk with Michigan Radio's senior news analyst Jack Lessenberry about what's going on in state politics. A state House panel is looking into whether to expel or censure two lawmakers caught up in a sex and cover-up scandal. This week, an internal investigation found Representatives Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat misused taxpayer resources to cover up an affair. Jack, what strikes you most about this whole thing?
Well, probably the fact that it's paralyzed the legislature into focusing on this instead of other things that they're doing. Everybody wants the two representatives to quit and go away. They have no influence anymore. They've been stripped of their committee work, but they won't quit. And they probably will expel them. There's a new committee looking at what to do about them. But meantime, it sucks up all the air in the room, and people are talking of very little else.
What does this mean for Michigan state politics?
Well, it means things are sort of on hold politically. It sort of is an embarrassment for the Tea Party, although the Tea Party people have repudiated them as well. Part of it, it's not just a case of an affair. It's a case of sort of, you know, hypocrisy. They were flamboyant fundamentalist Christians, but they also were not team players. Cindy Gamrat was very early on thrown out of the Republican caucus for leaking confidential information. Todd Corser sort of bragged that he didn't know anything about procedure and didn't care and wasn't interested in passing legislation. So if they leave, it'll have no effect on the balance of power. They probably will be replaced in special elections by other Republicans. Politically, it doesn't mean a lot, but it's just sort of paralyzing government.
The city of Flint is complying with a court order to lower water rates. Although it's appealing the order, the city is also appealing a class action lawsuit that could force the city to repay ratepayers millions of dollars. Meanwhile, the mayor received 26,000 petition signatures yesterday demanding a return to Detroit's water system. And some recent tests show high levels of lead in the water. Why is Flint having so many problems with its water system?
Flint has really had a mess with its water system for the last couple of years. The city decided to switch from using City Detroit water to water from another source. But in the meantime, they started using water out of the Flint River, and there's all sorts of problems with that. It was discolored. It was apparently tainted. The city put massive amounts of chemicals in there to kill any bacteria, and that caused health effects on people. People were just very unhappy. And 4 years ago, the city put in a massive rate hike, 35%, on customers of the water system. Now, of course, Flint has all sorts of economic problems. It's they've lost a lot of automotive jobs. A lot of people couldn't afford the pay. And so now you have this judge saying the city has to stop doing that. So the city lowered its water rates. A third of the customers were delinquent anyway. People stopped paying part of their water bill after that happened. And what it means is there's less revenue for the city, which didn't have enough revenue in the first place. Right now, everything is a mess, and nobody is satisfied with the water situation in Flint.
What's the answer?
Eventually, the city's contracted with something called the Carignani Water Authority, and they're going to be supplied with water from Lake Huron, but they have to complete work on a new system, and that's not going to be complete till next year.
And finally, Michigan intends to develop its own plan to comply with new federal rules to reduce greenhouse gases. The director of the Michigan Agency for Energy says it makes sense for the state to develop its own plan that takes into account its environment and energy needs. But Michigan won't join a lawsuit filed by State Attorney General Bill Schuette challenging the new standards. What is Schuette's argument?
Well, there are some who say that Schuette is mainly playing to the right wing of his party. He wants to get the Republican nomination for governor in 3 years. I can tell you, if there's a contested primary, Governor Snyder will not vote for Bill Schuette. He and Bill Schuette have been at odds in a lot of things. Bill Schuette opposed Proposal 1, the governor's plan to fix the roads, which of course was defeated. And he's sort of off on his own with some other Republican attorney generals arguing that the president's clean power plan is unconstitutional to begin with.
All right, Jack, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's senior news analyst.
There's a little bit of our end theme for the last several weeks. We're not ending yet. No, don't turn out. There's a lot coming here. Rockin' in the Free World by Neil Young, which, the hairy Republican, yes, Donald Trump. Anyway, he decided to use it for his campaign theme, and Neil Young said, "Don't you dare, I'm for Bernie Sanders." So, but in honor of that, I don't know, that commitment or snafu, however you see it, we will play that a little later in the show. So happy to, very happy to be with you today, even in a pre-recorded version. Okay. And so we just played from Michigan Radio, MichiganRadio.org, their sort of Wednesday update on the news with Jack Lessenberry. We may hear more from him later. At this point, we've got a few stories remaining here. Let's see here. Yes. Okay. Okay. Well, as we do usually, and sometimes I start with these things, of course, this weekend is Labor Day weekend, and I know I'm going out of town, I'm driving, so be careful out there, folks, as I usually say that every week, but especially true, there'll be a lot of people out on the roads. Maybe some of them haven't been out on those roads for a while, and so be very generous and courteous, and don't try to go as fast as possible, just be safe as possible. That's the word from here at WHFR. We need all the listeners we can get, so we don't want to lose anyone from traffic fatality. And as long as we bring this up, here's a story from MLive.com. What's the deadliest holiday? 11 facts about highway fatalities. And here they go. And this is about Michigan, too. So just in case you wondered. Number one, traffic fatalities are down 24% in the past decade in Michigan. So we're doing pretty good. And Michigan numbers mirror a nationwide trend. And of course, one factor is people are driving less because gasoline has cost more in the last decade than previously. Michigan's accident rate has stayed about the same when looking at estimated vehicle miles traveled, however, according to the state police data. So when crashes do occur, they're less likely to be fatal. That's an additional fact. Some experts point to improved safety features in new cars, such as electronic stability control systems, to make vehicles less likely to flip. That's never nice. Number two, half the people who died in Michigan traffic accidents were properly restrained by a seatbelt or a car seat. So in 2014, 51% of people killed in a crash were using proper restraints, which is about average for the past decade. But another 32% were pedestrians or on a bicycle, motorcycle, or snowmobile. See, that's called a traffic accident, folks. Even if it doesn't involve the car at all, it's out there in the traffic, okay? And that leaves 70% who were unrestrained inside a motor vehicle. So is that three times more likely to I'm not going to quote statistics unless I get my paper and pencil out. So that's how it is. So even though you might have your seatbelt on, you could still die. Okay, don't think your seatbelt, I'll just buckle up my seatbelt and I'll survive anything. That's not true. You can see by that, that's not true. However, you're much more likely to survive. A little more than, point number three, a little more than a third of Michigan's fatal crashes, involved a driver using alcohol and or drugs. And so that's 36%, and that's not good. So if you drink, don't drive. If you drive, don't drink. If you're a bicyclist, don't drink. If you're a motorcyclist, don't drink. Okay? It all contributes to fatalities. Traffic accidents kill twice as many men as women. Maybe they drive more. I don't know. I didn't figure that one out. About half of those who die in a crash, point number five, are driving a vehicle. Six, most fatal crashes occur on a local street. We talked about motorcyclists last week, and as I said, 12% were on a motorcycle who died in 2014, and that's unfortunate, but most fatal, and we can do better. Of course, I don't have a follow-up on those details. I wondered about the tragic crash of a motorcyclist last week, a recent graduate from Dearborn High School. Number six, most fatal crashes occur on a local street or county road versus a state or federal highway. So it's very dangerous, by the numbers, folks, around town. Okay. Rural counties have a disproportionate number of fatalities. So even if it's not heavily populated, maybe people are just not as careful because they think, well, there's no cars out there. I'll just drive like 100 miles an hour around this corner or something, with some crazy statement such as that, and that doesn't work out too well. Number eight, December and January, the worst months for traffic accidents in general, but fatal crashes peak in the summer. Guess what? It's summer, folks. July and August are the worst. Friday is the most common day of the week for traffic accidents in general. I'm glad I'm leaving on Thursday. But fatal crashes are more common on Saturdays. So more accidents on Friday, but more fatalities on Saturday. Could be coincidence. It's hard to say. 10 fatal crashes are most likely to occur in the evening, but after midnight is also a dangerous time, interestingly. And 11 societal trends are contributing to the drop in fatal accidents. Okay. The declining dependency on cars is part of a national trend. And here's a factor about that. One is a stagnant economy and people are tightening their budgets. In addition, many millennials, that's people born after the year 2000, are less likely to own a car than young adults in previous generations. Good for them. It's hard to depend on public transit in the Detroit area, but there are some cities in Michigan. If you live in the downtown area, even in Detroit downtown, depending on what neighborhoods, you can walk to work. And what a concept. Or bicycle to work in good weather. Finally, concerns about climate change and sedentary lifestyles means that people are walking, biking, or using mass transit as a mode of transportation. So that all helps those criteria, but just saying, be careful out there. Labor Day weekend is approaching. And what is that? Well, from the always accurate pages of Wikipedia on the internet, Labor Day in the United States is a public holiday celebrated on the first Monday in September. It honors the American labor movement, and workers' contributions have made that also honors the contributions that workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of this country. It was first promoted by, guess what, labor unions, the Central Labor Union and the Knights of Labor, who organized the first parade in New York City. And that was in 1886. However, in 1887, after the Haymarket Massacre in Chicago on May 4th, 1886, U.S. President Grover Cleveland feared that commemorating Labor Day on May 1st, which is known as sort of Universal Labor Day throughout the world, Workers' Day, could become an opportunity to commemorate the affair, which nobody wanted to remember. Therefore, in 1887, the United States holiday was established in September to support that same Labor Day that the Knights of Labor favored. The Knights of Labor, that was the name of the labor organization. By the way, Canada's Labor Day is also celebrated on the first Monday of September. But they're the only ones that have it on the first day of September. Is that because of U.S. tourists coming over with great sales in the stores? They wanted to be competitive. You know, Labor Day is a big shopping day. Oh, yeah. If everybody's off, what do? If you can't leave town, you go shopping, I guess. And so it's a big day for stores to stay open to sell you stuff. And by the way, our labor unions got the idea of a festival, a parade, because there was an annual labor festival held in Toronto, Canada, as early as 1882. So there you go. You might wonder about the Haymarket Affair, and just a little history on that. Again, it was 1886, May 4th. It was a bombing that happened after a labor demonstration in Chicago. So it's Haymarket Square in Chicago, 1886, began as a peaceful rally in support of workers striking for an eight-hour day. That's right. We hadn't obtained the eight-hour day limit in those days. And what allowed workers to not have to work 10 or 12 hours a day? Labor unions and protest marches. Yep, peaceful marches. Well, at the end of the march, an unknown person threw a dynamite bomb, I guess they didn't have C4 in those days, at police as they acted to disperse the public meeting. The bomb blast and ensuing gunfire resulted in deaths of 7 police officers and at least 4 civilians. Scores of others were wounded. Of course, I asked the question, who are they shooting at? I mean, apparently it was the police shooting. I don't know. But they did an investigation. And legal proceedings followed. 8 anarchists, not labor union people, but 8 anarchists were convicted of conspiracy. The evidence was that one of the defendants may have built the bomb, but it was clear by the trial that none of them had thrown it. 7 were sentenced to death and 1 to a term of 15 years in prison. You get the idea from what I just said here, folks? There wasn't enough evidence to convict any of these people of anything, but they were anarchists, and you got to find a scapegoat or the government looks bad, right? That's apparently what happened. Or maybe to cover up the gunfire from the police. Now, more police died than protesters in this terrible event. However, the death sentence of 2 of the defendants were commuted by Illinois Governor Richard J. Oglesby to terms of life in prison, which wasn't fair either, but at least they didn't die. And but another committed suicide in jail rather than face the gallows. The other 4 were hanged on November 11th, 1887. But in 1893, Illinois' new governor, John Peter Altgeld, pardoned the remaining defendants and criticized the trial. It, you know, finally, okay, none of them should have been convicted of anything or killed. But, boy, after an event, somebody's got to pay, even if they're not guilty, it seems. We must be so careful after moments like this, not rush to judgment or, may I say, rush to war. A little allusion there to certain wars that our country has gotten into in the last couple decades. Okay. A labor studies professor, William J. Alderman, had this quote, "No single event has influenced the history of labor in Illinois, the United States, and even the world more than the Chicago Haymarket Affair. It began with the rally on May 4th, 1886, but the consequences are still being felt today. Although the rally is included in American history textbooks, very few present the event accurately or point out its significance. Because some of the things that happened, of course, was additional scapegoating of so-called anarchists, people that believed, not in throwing bombs, but believed that all government was evil. This is not like a Tea Party or who wants limited government. This is all government is evil and should be resisted. And, of course, there was terrible, terrible trials and really gathering up of large groups of people, deporting them from New York City around World War I. I can't remember the dates now. They even passed a law in the United States taking away the basic rights of recent immigrants. I think these were a lot of Italians in the New York City area that were focused on. And they didn't know which might have been anarchists, so they just arrested the whole neighborhood. Yeah, that's not a good moment in U.S. history either. Hope that got into history books, because that should never happen again. Although, a couple people, including a former U.S. military officer that I mentioned on the show a couple weeks ago, has come out in the press saying anybody that even thinks of terrorism should be rounded up without trial and sent to a concentration camp. Well, he didn't call it that. Imprisoned in a containment area in this country. All right. No trial. No evidence. But they're a terrorist. And why are you a terrorist again? What does it take to be a terrorist? Only if the government says you are. Then you are. No proof required. You say, well, where did that come from? The Patriot Act that has not been repealed yet, although it's been modified a little bit, but the one that got passed right after 9/11. And it's got to be repealed because it's against every principle of American liberty that's in our founding documents and in our history up until 9/11. Times have not changed so much. And if we take away all that freedom and liberty that was guaranteed to us in the beginning, the terrorists, or the people out there that don't like the U.S., to be more specific, and want to hurt us in some way, to be more specific, they've won. Because taking away our freedoms from ourselves, which made us so different and so much better than them, it's ended if we do it ourselves. So we can't let the people who are against our country win, but we can't do it by hurting ourselves and our basic traditions and principles of liberty. Another editorial opinion. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Here's, another story, local. I'll toss this in, and we've got a couple opinions. We are about 32 minutes into the hour. Another 28 minutes to go for the new WHFR Journal. And I've got a lot of stuff in front of me here that we can focus on. A couple more opinions from Jack Lessenberry and Jim Hightower coming up, too. Here's a local story that just broke yesterday from the News Herald. This is the voice of Downriver. U.S. News and World Report magazine. Yes, they're still publishing. I believe they're still a weekly. They have ranked Taylor Kennedy High School and Melvindale High School in the top 25% of schools in the entire United States. The honors in the annual ranking were handed out in three tiers, gold, silver, and bronze. Obviously, gold is best, silver is second best, and bronze is third. Well, both Downriver schools were in the bronze category. Kennedy made the list for the second straight year. Last year, Taylor Truman and Lincoln Park were also honored, but not this year. The magazine analyzed data from 20,000 public high schools. It first determined whether each school's students were performing better on standardized tests than statistically expected for the average student in the state. But then, aha, the magazine then factored in the percentage of economically disadvantaged students who tend to score lower to identify the schools that were performing better than expected, despite the disadvantaged students in their population. For schools that cleared that hurdle, the next step was to determine whether a school's least advantaged students, Black, Hispanic, and low income, were performing better than average for similar students in the state. So that's a separate criteria just for the least advantaged students, and they defined them as Black, Hispanic, and low income. Obviously, there could be some overlapping there. And so however you qualify, you qualify, and they look at your how you're doing. The magazine also looked at what steps the schools were taking to prepare students for college. So we don't know how many points they gave in their rating system for programs to help them with college. But of course, people in Melvindale and Taylor say they're very honored and they're going to keep trying to do things. Apparently, there's a partnership between Melvindale Northern in Allen Park and also Wayne County Community College, allowing high school students to earn college credits while still in high school. And in Melvindale, they're trying to look at maybe dual enrollment with Baker College, which is a private school, several campuses around that area. I think maybe just one in Allen Park, I don't know. But in any event, if they got to pay full tuition, Baker College is pretty expensive, though. But if you're going to go there anyway, you'd still have to pay it. Wayne County Community College, they're looking at two for that associate's degree while in high school. Now, you might say, well, these sort of things seem familiar. Why wasn't Dearborn in there? What about the odds on these things? And how did Dearborn do? What percentage was Dearborn in the area? So we don't know exactly from the story because it was published in the Downriver News Herald. Okay. So I did go to U.S. News and World Report's reporter that I am. 30 seconds of my time. Glad to do it, folks. And I looked at the ratings, and in the top 100, no, Dearborn is not listed. Not even in Michigan. But I think that's because of this extra factor about the disadvantaged students. I don't really think we have very many. So I have a feeling that if you have more disadvantaged students that you're serving and doing special things for them, really being successful with them, it's going to push you higher up in the ranking. Can't be sure of that, but it gave me that impression. Again, the full criteria for the selection even wasn't on the U.S. News and World Magazine website, but that would be my guess. So Dearborn, hey, they've got this two wonderful programs, just won an award between the Dearborn Public Schools and Henry Ford Community College called Early College. And right now, that program only serves people going into the Allied Health area. But for just a little extra time, like one more year, they can start taking classes at Henry Ford College while they're still in high school, and they can get that associate's degree within about a year. And it was rated, I don't have that story in front of me right now, the top high school program in the country. Oh, my gosh. Not by U.S. News and World Report, but based on other criteria, that was very special. Now, in Dearborn, we also have that program whereby qualified students in high school in their junior year can start taking classes at Henry Ford College, and they call it something other than early college. So, and I don't remember what that is either. But those students also, just one more year, and they'll get an Associate of Arts degree here at Henry Ford College. And I think it's a general degree, but maybe they can major in whatever area they want to in those first 2 years of general education credits, as well as going to high school. And the good part about that, and maybe true also with early college, not sure, is that there's no additional cost, except maybe for textbooks. I think they don't get textbooks free. And textbooks, are a pretty sizable expense in college. And you wouldn't believe how much textbooks cost these days. I wouldn't believe that Many textbooks start at about $100 each. And why do they? Because there's a limited number of them published, and because the publisher can get away with it. If your teacher says you got to have that book, then you got to get that book. You got to pay the price for that book. That's not anything the schools can do about. But they're expensive. But other than that, this special program where you can be in Dearborn High School, and if you qualify, again, you've got to be a good student and get your, you know, your grades have to be substantial in that, then you can definitely make a go of it here at Henry Ford College, and no extra tuition. And you've got your first 2 years out of the way, only 1 year out of high school. And you can transfer anywhere you want to for the last 2 years. Or stay here at Henry Ford College, since we now have cooperative programs with three schools: Madonna, Siena Heights, and Eastern Michigan University, right on campus. Isn't that amazing? That's called our University Center. I sound like a PR recording for Henry Ford College today, but these are stories I haven't done much of in the past, and college didn't tell me to say these things. That's a wonderful thing about Henry Ford College and WHFR. They've never told us what to say or what to play. So we're trying to be responsible, but it's your tax dollars at work here, so I'm going to tell you what I know, and hopefully I get the story straight, and you can appreciate or not what is happening over here at Henry Ford College if you're listening to this regularly. And I know you are. So all very excited about that. And, of course, our own four-year program that I mentioned before will begin next January officially. That is a Henry Ford College four-year degree, bachelor's degree, in hospitality studies and culinary arts. Yep, thanks to the state of Michigan, we're able to do that all by ourselves. And we also think, maybe in the next year, at most, we'll get permission to go with the four-year nursing degree right here. Henry Ford College bachelor's degrees are coming because the state legislature knows certain community colleges have very advanced, very high-quality programs in several areas. Henry Ford College is certainly up there with the best in terms of hospitality, culinary arts, and allied health programs. So, Dearborn, don't get upset if you hear about Taylor Kennedy and Melvindale High Schools being in the top 25%, and we're not. I think it was different criteria. We're doing an awful lot here for the students. I know later this fall, hope to have the new superintendent, Greg Maletko, from Dearborn, on the show, so he can talk about his initiatives, being new in office, and his thoughts about moving ahead. Okay, here's a comment from Jim Hightower. Before we move to the larger scope, let's take Jack Lessenberry's comment. No, not the same comment that I played before, about Michigan's clean power plan. Yes, there is one. Clean power, imagine. No pollution. It would not hurt our environment. So no fracking, no oil pumping. You get the idea? Clean air, clean water, uber alles. That's the important concept here. And let's hear Jack Lessenberry's comments from Michigan Radio.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Some days I find myself wishing President Obama would make a speech honoring motherhood and propose a program to honor mothers. If he did that, it's very clear most Republicans would refuse to support honoring mothers. I'm not sure if they'd oppose motherhood itself or just say that Barack Obama was a Kenyan socialist who couldn't possibly have had a mother. But I am sure that Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette would immediately join a lawsuit arguing that motherhood was unconstitutional. That's a parody, but not much of one.
Last month, the president and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, announced a clean power plan designed to reduce carbon pollution from existing power plants. This was a long overdue and flexible plan that allows for variation in what individual states do, depending on their energy mix. States are being encouraged to come up with their own plans to meet the federal mandates. Yesterday, the Snyder administration announced it's doing that and was encouraging utilities and other stakeholders to work with the state in developing one. Valerie Brader, director of the Michigan Agency for Energy, said, "Michigan remains committed to creating an energy future that is affordable, adaptable, reliable, and protective of the environment." Rather than waiting for the federal government to impose its own plan on Michigan, she and State Environmental Quality Director Dan Wyant said it made far more sense for the state to develop a plan tailored to Michigan's needs. Michigan, by the way, probably needs a clean power and carbon emissions plan more than most states. We still get half our power by burning coal, a fuel that made sense in the time of Charles Dickens. 4 years ago, a Michigan Environmental Council study found our 9 oldest coal plants cost state residents about $1.5 billion a year in increased health care costs. They aren't good for people in neighboring states and Canada, either. Naturally, Bill Schuette is joining some other Republican attorneys general in suing the Obama administration, claiming the president's clean power plan is illegal and unconstitutional. Significantly, spokespersons for the Snyder administration yesterday said they had no interest in that. They're more interested in getting something meaningful done. Now, if all this elicits a sense of what Yogi Berra called deja vu all over again, it should. 2 years ago, Michigan had the option of creating a state health care exchange or directory to comply with the Affordable Care Act. Governor Snyder tried to do that, but it was killed by Republicans in the State House who hated Obamacare so much they refused to do anything to go along with it. So they killed the exchange, and a less good federal one was imposed on us instead, an act of spite which cost Michigan $40 million. Yesterday, there were signs Republican legislators may have learned from the experience. After his ritual denunciation of the Clean Power Plan as an abuse of federal power, State Senator Mike Shirkey told the Gongra News Service, "I believe we need to come up with our own plan to make the best of what he believes is state power run amok." Well, what do you know? Once in a while, people do learn from their mistakes.
Jack Lassenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst.
Oh, yes, I know you're waiting for our final theme. I know you are, rocking in the free world. It's actually still a few minutes away. Okay, you still have to wait about 9 minutes, and then, yeah, you can rock it out as you wait for the next show, which we expect to be, as on almost every Friday, Joanne Korchinska's Highway 61, the best in the blues for 4 hours. A lot of local blues, a lot of indie, that is blues that is not being focused on nationally but should be. You'll hear it all right here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves from 2 to 6 p.m. as we do every Friday. This show, of course, you can listen to again. So you can listen to the pre-record or the pre-recorded show. Again, from our website, whfr.fm, anytime after broadcast. And, of course, we broadcast every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. We'll be live in the studio again next week, Friday, though, September 11th. Continuing on. Okay. Well, we're getting into time here that we can actually talk about opinions. Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. Look out. Look out. Yeah, opinions. Well, talking about the Labor Day theme, okay, here is an opinion from Robert Reich. It's R-E-I-C-H, okay? And let me give you his background. He is one of the nation's leading experts on work and the economy. He's Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. So he's a University of California at Berkeley professor. In an endowed chair. Ooh. He has served in 3 national administrations, that's presidential level. Most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. Time magazine has named him one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the last century. He has written 13 books, including the latest bestseller, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Subtitled The Work of Nations, Locked in the Cabinet, Supercapitalism, and also his newest, Beyond Outrage. His syndicated columns, television appearances, and public radio commentaries reach millions of people each week. He is the founding editor of American Prospect magazine and chairman of the group's citizen group, Common Cause, which is a nonprofit group lobbying Congress to do the right thing. In other words, a lobbying group that's saying, don't pay attention to all these other lobbyists. We are here for the good of the public. Yeah, the people as a whole. So the people as a whole do have a lobbyist, a nonprofit organization is advocating what's good for the public. Of course, if you wanted to contribute to Common Cause, it's not tax deductible. Yes, it is organized as a nonprofit, but because they do influence, they hope, on our politicians, your support for Common Cause, if you choose to do so, is not tax deductible. It's not a commercial. I just, in saying they're a nonprofit, I think of them that way because they're not looking for a personal profit. They're doing things for the good of the public in general as they see them. But contributions are not tax deductible, just like they wouldn't be to any lobbyist group or political campaign. So if you give money in this political campaign coming up, any political campaign, it's not tax deductible on your federal tax return and not at all, of course, on the state return. Well, here's what Robert Reich, now that you know how famous he is and his academic credentials, has to say about, in fact, the article is entitled Labor Day 2028. Autonomous robots are at work in a paper factory, and they show a picture here. Wow, autonomous robots. In 1928, the famous British economist John Maynard Keynes, that's K-E-Y-N-E-S, predicted that technology would advance so far in 100 years by 2028 that it will replace all work and no one will need to worry about making money. Quote, for the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his permanent problem, how to use his freedom from pressing economic cares, how to occupy the leisure, which science and compound interest will have won for him to live wisely and agreeably and well, unquote. Robert Reich says we still have 13 years to go before we reach Keynes' prophetic year, but we're not exactly on the way to it. Americans are working harder than ever. Keynes may be proven right about technological progress. We're on the verge of 3D printing, driverless cars, delivery drones, and robots that can serve us coffee in the morning and make our beds. Ooh, I didn't hear about that one. Wow. Make our beds. Wow. That would be great. Oh, going on. But he overlooked one big question, how to redistribute the profits from these marvelous labor-saving inventions so we'll have the money to buy the free time they provide. Without such a mechanism, Robert Reich says, most of us are condemned to work ever harder in order to compensate for lost earnings due to the labor replacing technologies. Such technologies are even replacing knowledge workers, a big reason why college degrees no longer deliver steadily higher wages and larger shares of the economic pie. Since 2000, the vast majority of college graduates have seen little or no income gains. The economic model that predominated through most of the 20th century was mass production by many, for mass consumption by many. But the model we're rushing towards is unlimited production by a handful for consumption by the few able to afford it. The ratio of employees to customers is already dropping to mind-boggling lows. When Facebook purchased the messaging company WhatsApp for $19 billion last year, WhatsApp had 55 employees serving 450 million customers. When more and more can be done by fewer and fewer people, profits go to an ever smaller circle of executives and or investors. WhatsApp, young co-founder and CEO Jan Koum, got $6.8 billion in the deal. This in turn will leave the rest of us with fewer well-paying jobs and less money to buy what can be produced as we've pushed into the low-paying personal service sector of the economy, which will also mean fewer profits for the handful of billionaire executives and owner investors because potential consumers won't be able to afford what they're selling. Yep. What to do? We might try to levy a gigantic tax on the incomes of the billionaire winners and redistribute their winnings to everyone else. But even if politically feasible, the winners will be tempted to store their winnings abroad or expatriate, which means go live abroad. Suppose we look instead at the patents and trademarks by which government protects all these new inventions. So here's the new idea, folks. Such government protections determine what these inventions are worth. If patents lasted only 3 years instead of the current 20, for example, what's up, would be worth a small fraction of $19 billion because after 3 years, anybody could reproduce its message technology for free. Instead of shortening the patent period, how about giving every citizen a share of profits from all patents and trademarks that government protects? It would be a condition for receiving such protection. Say, for example, 20% of all such profits were split equally among all citizens starting the month they turn 18. In effect, this would be a basic minimum income for everyone. The sum would be enough to ensure everyone a minimally decent standard of living, including money to buy the technologies that would free them up from the necessity of working. Anyone wishing to supplement their basic minimum could, of course, choose to work, even though, as noted, most jobs will pay modestly. This outcome would also be good for the handful of billionaire executives and owner investors because it would ensure that they have customers with enough money to buy their labor-saving gadgets. Such a basic minimum would allow people to pursue whatever arts or avocations provide them with meaning, thereby enabling society to enjoy the fruits of such artistry or voluntary efforts. We would thereby create the kind of society John Maynard Keynes predicted we'd achieve by 2018, an age of technological abundance in which no one will need to work. Happy Labor Day, he says. It's the opinion of Robert Reich. You can look at more at robertreich.org. And so we're coming to the end of today's episode, pre-recorded, of the new WHFR Journal. Again, I recorded this only 2 days before the September 4th broadcast date, so it's pretty up to date. By all means, go out there and search for the latest news yourself. Subscribe to both Dearborn papers and ask a lot of questions of your local representatives. It is Labor Day weekend. Have a safe and pleasant weekend. Don't buy too much, but come on back alive. This is WHFR Dearborn. And now, the song you've been waiting for. Take care out there, rockin' in the free world. We'll be right back.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Hey, what's up? This is Tim from Alistair, and you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves.
Highway 61, the longest highway that I know.
I'm Joanne Korchenska, and I've been cruising down Highway 61 for 21 years now. Join me every Friday from 2 to 6 p.m. to hear the newest blues music and classic blues, too. Check it out every Friday from 2 to 6 p.m. Highway 61. It's all good.
Traveling all the time. That's where my baby stays.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Highway 61, the longest highway that I know.
I'm Joanne Korchenska, and I've been cruising down.